Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more. We're going to have a really interesting talk today. You'll see. And I can tell you in advance that no matter how much ground we cover in this hour, it won't be enough. So you're going to want to probably follow up on some of the leads that we laid down tonight, because you'll see. So we're talking with Dave Selzer, and Dave wears at least two hats. One of them is scientist, and the other is musician, and he's accomplished in both areas. And we're going to talk about a book that's coming out soon, might already be out by the time this recording hits the air, called Music, Math, and Mind. But I'm also going to take this occasion to talk with Dave about his experiences as a musician, specifically in those heady years in the 1980s, the early 1980s, where New York was a music wonderland. So, Dave, you're originally from Illinois?
I grew up in Carbondale, Illinois, small town, southern Illinois.
And then you ended up in a big town or a small town in Connecticut?
Yeah, so my dad died, and my mother remarried, and she's a psychologist, of course, retired now. And she married a physics professor at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. So I spent my junior and senior year of high school in Storrs, Connecticut, which is northeast Connecticut, not so far from Hartford, about 25 miles
gotcha.
From Hartford.
Gotcha. And somewhere along the line, you got exposed to salsa. And I know that Hartford now has a pretty big Latino population. Is that how you – I mean, When somebody like you or I falls in love with salsa at a young age, which I did as well, by the way, It's out of the ordinary. How did you come across salsa? I mean, it was in the air. I remember.
Well, you're right. I mean, so the high schools that Illinois had, you know, it didn't really have a Latino, that part of Illinois didn't have a Latino population except for migrant workers from Mexico who would come in, you know, seasonally. So, you know, what we're dealing with now in 2021 and so on is why, honestly, I grew up with it, you know, seeing farm workers come in, because the part of the country I grew up in, it's mostly big for cattle farming and fruit farming, because it's sort of the Ozark Mountains down there, which is, I know, strange for Illinois, but this is like 90 miles south of St. Louis. So it's not so far from where Miles Davis grew up. And there's a lot of jazz and blues and country music down there. And then some fruit trees, especially apples and some peaches and things like that. And now they're even growing grapes for wine in southern Illinois. Apparently does pretty well down there. So, but even when I was a young kid, farm workers would come in from Mexico. But, of course, they were completely unintegrated into the local, you know, the local small towns. And I'm not sure I'd even say ostracized. It was just, you know, they were families that would come in and work the farms and then leave. And of course, I've always wondered about them, but none of the kids went to school with us. Our town was incredibly segregated in a way, in that on one side of the town, one side of the train tracks, we had a train that ran from New Orleans to Chicago. It went through Memphis and went through southern Illinois. And literally one side of the train tracks were for the black people and the other side for the white people. And yet it was much more integrated than, I'd say, New York of now, because we all went to school together. Everybody knew everybody else's family, et cetera. So it was this odd it was this odd American thing, very strange. But now you were asking about how I fell in love with salsa. Right. In Illinois, I never heard music from Puerto Rico, Cuba. I had no idea what, I mean, of course I knew what, and I was very curious about music back then. But as you'll remember, Ken, and this will not make sense to younger people listening, back then, if you wanted to know about new music, you had to buy a record. You literally had to go to a record shop and buy a record. That's how you learned about new music, or you were able to hear it on the radio. We got covered by St. Louis radio, so I heard a lot. You know, Chuck Berry lived there, and you know, all the, you know, heavy metal was big, and when I was a kid, and all that. So and country and blues and rhythm and blues. You know, Isaac Hayes was incredibly popular when I was in junior high school. People would carry Isaac Hayes lunchboxes to school and stuff. But you know, so you know, Stax Volt, Motown. All that, you know, Chicago stuff, everything there was real. But Latin music, just, it wasn't on the radio. And, you know, I don't think it was ever carried in the record stores. Although I have to say, I did buy a Paco de Lucia record. So I actually heard flamenco when I was a young kid, because Paco was already known to some Cañashenti for some reason. I mean, probably because he was so good. And also when I was, I don't know, about 13, 14, I heard Sabicas for the first time. So I heard flamenco and liked it, didn't understand it at all. Of course, it's tremendously different music from American music, even if a lot of our roots come from the flamenco tradition. We don't know it, but, you know, the rhythms have changed so much, the harmonies have changed so much, you know. So it sounds extremely foreign to us, even if it's part of our own ancestry. So when I moved to Storrs, Connecticut, you're right, there was a big Latin population, mostly Puerto Rican population, both in Hartford and the other town that was only about 6 miles away, which is called Willimantic, Connecticut. So Willimantic had a very large Puerto Rican population because it was a mill town. And what they would do, I mean, this is really vicious, is they would go to Puerto Rico, tell people, come up to Willimantic, and you're going to, you know, get great jobs working in the mill. And people would move up there, and there would be no jobs. And now they're stuck in Willimantic. Mm. And so there was a large Puerto Rican population there. And on the radio, you know, this is both, you know, commercial radio and also the college radio at the University of Connecticut, because, you know, they would have Puerto Rican American, you know, Puerto Rican / Connecticut disc jockeys. And that's where I heard Eddie Palmieri. And I just, I remember hearing it so vividly and just going like, oh my God, I can't believe how astonishing this music is. And I know the songs. It was Puerto Rico, which is still one of my favorite songs. I believe it features Yomo Toro, the great trace player. And so you might want to play a little bit of that. And also Una Dia Bonita. Okay. And these were great, great pieces, and the arrangements were amazing. Now, I thought at the time that they were Eddie's arrangements, and I understand now that they were probably, or they were, Barry Rogers, you know, his lead trombone player. The guy that really introduced trombones to salsa was Barry Rogers, and Barry wrote it. So Chris Washburn, a friend of mine who played in La Perfecta, not the original one, but the current version of Eddie Palmieri's classic group La Perfecta, said, what you thought was Eddie was actually Barry. But it didn't matter.
Okay.
Eddie is an amazing pianist, band leader. I mean, he's always, since that day, he's been one of my musical heroes. And I'm probably giving more detail than you want to know, but those songs made me go like, okay, I want to be a composer. Because you know, I grew up in the Midwest, like I've been saying, and you put together a band, and everybody just figures out their own parts, and all that's great. You know, it's made a tremendous amount of great music. But when I heard Palmieri, I realized, oh no, this had to come from somebody who figured it all out and wrote it down. There's no way that these amazing harmonies were improvised separately.
Gotcha. Chris Washburn write a book? Did he write The Salsa Wars?
I don't know if he wrote that one, but he wrote a couple of books on salsa.
Okay.
I'm very fortunate. Chris plays on a whole bunch of my records, and he's just been a great fellow adventurer for a long time.
Oh, you know what? He wrote Sounding Salsa, and I think Salsa Wars might have been a chapter, possibly.
Well,
but
Chris is a great jazz player as well as a great salsa player. And in a lot of my recordings, he plays essentially classical trombone. So he can do, he has a, you know, wide intellect and extraordinary skill set. So he's somebody you really ought to bring on your show sometime.
Thank you for that tip. I think I'm going to do that because that book is fascinating. That really opened my eyes as to just a lot of the practicalities of what that scene was like and what fueled it and what kept it going and how wild it was socially in addition to musically. For people that may not be aware, the 70s in particular in New York City was just the most amazing flowering of music. And one of the things that flowered amazingly was salsa.
Oh, yeah.
But that was only one hit. You had punk rock going on.
Yeah,
had,
and Johnny Pacheco just passed. He passed a couple
yeah.
weeks ago. He was one of the founders
yeah.
of Fania, which, you know, I mean, I know all those, you know, there were little record company skirmishes and stuff like that. But there's no doubt about, you know, that Fania with Pacheco and a lawyer, Italian-American lawyer named Jerry Masucci, that these guys really, really, really advanced the ability of people to be adventurous and, you know, experiment and make that music popular. It's kind of amazing, right? And it's still incredibly popular. You know, people in, at least in New York City, and also I have, my brother married a woman from Colombia. So I therefore inherited all these Colombian relatives. And as soon as you put on a Willie Colon record, everybody gets up and dances. It's, you know, it's just still, even if that music is now about 50 years old, it doesn't matter. It's still the music, you know. It's still central music.
And yeah, I've heard it everywhere. I've been in Latin America too, in Mexico on street corners and
exactly.
Did
New York salsa. Willie Colon, Eddie Palmieri, Larry Harlow, you know, the Johnny Pacheco, all these kind of people, Ray Barreto, you know, all these people are like celebrated throughout the Spanish speaking world, even in Spain. Even in Spain, because I spent a bunch of time in Spain. And, you know, I mean, southern Spain is, of course, it's the home of flamenco, but there's a big love of New York salsa there. It's sort of the same way that hip-hop started here in New York and
mm-hmm.
spread throughout the world,
yep.
you know?
Yep.
And some other things.
And,
I mean, you could say minimalism did that, you know? Or you could say new wave or something, you know? I mean, and they kind of did, but it spread throughout the world.
And punk rock.
You think that you just play in little places with you know, the audience is tiny. One of my closest friends is a guy that passed about 4 or 5 years ago. His name is Giorgio Gomelski. And Giorgio was the original producer for the Rolling Stones. And he started a club called the Crawdaddy Club in London. And Giorgio would always tell me, you know, the first time the Rolling Stones played live, and that was at my club, and three people showed up.
Mm-hmm,
so he'd
mm-hmm.
love to tell that. Yeah. But that's how all these things start. They all start with a, you know, I don't know if it's a real quote from Margaret Mead, you know, or it's just the people ascribe it to her. But, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, don't feel bad that what you're doing has a, done by a very small group of people. That's the way things change. In fact, it's the only way things have ever changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember a quote like that from her. Yeah, that's a very important thing for people trying to get traction with something to keep in mind. Things often start very small, surprisingly small.
I think and especially, you know, with our mutual interest in music, I bet you could go through virtually any of these things and any of these styles and see how they began very small. Now, sometimes, you know, rarely they become hip-hop or salsa or minimalism or whatever, and then conquer the world. You know, usually they don't, but whatever they are, they, you know, whether they get a big audience or small audience, they probably develop a passionate audience because we're not that different from each other. So if you're making work that you think is beautiful, and you honestly, you're not, you know, doing it because, oh, I did it, therefore it's got to be great, you know, but instead you're working towards something that you know you need to work towards because of the beauty or the interest in it. that it's fascinating and important to you, it's going to be to somebody else too. It just is going to be, you know, maybe to a small number of people or maybe to an enormous number of people. I'm not sure that part of it matters, frankly, so much. I mean, you know, it does in popular culture. Sure, you know, in popular culture this year, Taylor Swift is 100 times better than John Coltrane because she sold 100 times more records. But, you know, in 10 years, it will be, yeah, you know, Taylor Swift was good, and so was John Coltrane, what they did. So, you know, that I wouldn't put too much worry about popularity. Popularity for everybody is temporary. You know, might have been lasting for Jesus for 2,000 years, but, you know, and even for him, it goes up and down. You know? So, right. You know, I wouldn't worry so much about that part of it. But the thing about, you know, Jesus believed in something, other people did. Muhammad did, other people, John Coltrane did, and people do. And I, you know, I don't know Taylor Swift, nor do I know those others, but I bet she does too. So, you know, it's more about like that we're really not that different. That's the point I'm trying to make. So I don't think Paul Mieri would have known that, you know, this kid from the Midwest who didn't know anything about Caribbean culture, except what seeped up to Illinois indirectly, would say like, oh my God, this is the music of my dreams. I've never heard it, but it immediately was like, this is the music I dreamt about, but I didn't know it. Right.
And did you get involved in playing salsa at that age?
No.
It was
a kid. There weren't those bands, but when I moved to New York, I did play charanga for a bit. So charanga is it's the kind of music that was very popular in the 80s. I don't even know, frankly, if it's played now, maybe at wedding bands or something. But it comes out of Cuba, but it had its own New York thing. And Johnny Pacheco, who we were just mentioning, was one of its big stars. And it used violins and flutes instead of, you know, trumpets.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a, I guess, quieter. You know, one of the reasons I'm convinced that New York salsa got represented by the trombones, right? That, to me, that's one of the big changes from Cuba music to salsa music. I understand there's other ones like, you know, more use of Puerto Rican rhythms versus Cuban and other things like that. But one of the big reasons is because they started using the trombones, which again goes to Barry Rogers, who was not Puerto Rican, I believe was Jewish, but grew up in a Puerto Rican neighborhood, in Westchester, and grew up with Paul Mieri and Eddie and his brother Charlie Paul Mieri and so on. And I think these guys were playing, I mean, I don't really have, even though I've known these people a little bit, I've never asked them this directly, but Chris can. I'm sure he already knows the answer. But when I have seen Latin groups play up, like on the street, literally on the street, in Harlem and North Manhattan, you know, Washington Heights and so on, they would have a microphone for the singer, but everybody else would be acoustic. That, you know, there wouldn't be a big PA system. And I think the trombone just cut, you know. You could hear a trombone on a crowded New York City street. And I think that's one of the reasons that trombone became emblematic, you know, became the sound. But they are also, in clubs, we would play charanga. And that everything would be mic'd. And you could hear the violins and the flutes and so on. So I did get to play a bit of salsa, but not really that much. It's like I played in, you know, mostly I played like when somebody else couldn't make it. Like I got one of the classic guys is Eddie Drennan, who you cannot believe Eddie Drennan's records. You have to look them up. This guy, who was a violin player, produced stuff that was and made his own records that sometimes they were traditional salsa records, but other times they were disco records. And they're the most amazing disco records that mix together Latin salsa, like deep Latin salsa, with disco, which was entirely natural for him because he was coming up in the disco era, but playing in Latin band. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Eddie Driscoll plays salsa and charanga like 100,000 times better than I do. But you know, once in a while he couldn't make a gig and I'd get a call.
Gotcha.
And the other guy that I filled in became a very, he's not well known, but he's a really good arranger and he had a, and I think still has a very good career, named Dave Rimless. And so when Dave or Eddie couldn't make the gig, sometimes I'd get the call, even though, you know, I couldn't play, you know, I can't play like those guys in that style, but you know, mm-hmm. they need a violin player, they need a violin player. So those were the salsa gigs I would tend to get. I did make friends with salsa people, and I do have a piece if you want to get to it. About a year or so ago, I wrote a piece that to me means something because I took some of the stuff I learned from Eddie Palmieri and put it into a piano piece. It's also got a lot of McCoy Tyner in it and even a little bit of Cecil Taylor. And I wrote it off for classical players. It's called Haleo. And there's a recording of it by Steve Beck. And it's really hard to play, but Steve does a great job. And, you know, it's sort of, for me, it's sort of like sending a letter to Palmieri and these people.
Beautiful. It's called Haleo.
Haleo. J-A-L-E-O.
Okay. And, wow, so many different directions we can go. And let's talk about violin a little bit, your instrument. And you played with Bo Diddley, who I didn't realize had started as a violinist, I guess, as a kid. Is that correct?
Yeah. So he and Leroy Jenkins went to school together, and they both told me independently that they used to play together. They used to play duos on the street in Southside Chicago, you know, for money, you know, people to
sure.
put money in the hat. And the funny thing yep. is, because I knew them both from separate scenes, I knew, so I was living in Gainesville, Florida, before I moved to New York. And why is Bo Diddley living in Gainesville, Florida? But he was. He had a farm and his family, and they lived on a farm outside of Gainesville. And I was playing guitar at the time in the kind of a classic Gainesville band. Old time Gainesvillers will remember this band. It's called the Gainesville Jazz All Stars. And it was run by Jimi Hendrix's cousin, Barney Hendrix. There's a part of the Hendrix family lives in Seattle and part of them lives around Gainesville. So Barney had this kid, I just forgot his first name, but another Hendrix. So, you know, a cousin of Jimmy. And this kid is amazing. He lives in upstate New York now. And he's this amazing guitar player, never became a star, but great singer, great guitar player. And then he moved to New York and so I started playing guitar with him and as Reggie Hendrix. So I became, you know, the guy that replaced Reggie Hendrix in this band. And it was a, you know, kind of a funky jazz southern R&B band that would play stuff like, you know, New Orleans funk and you know, like we'd play Watermelon Man and go on for half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And people would okay. dance like this really slow dance and, you know,
yep.
and blues
yep.
and, you know, deep, 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 you know, kind of jazz R&B. And so, you know, I got known as essentially as a Telecaster player playing that kind of sound. And so when Bo needed a guitar player, he called me. He even asked me to be his regular guitar player and go on the road with him. Because back then what he was doing was he would go from town to town and like Chuck Berry, rather than pay a band, he'd have the local players back him up. But the trouble is that, you know, often that wouldn't work because the players didn't know the material. So he wanted me to travel with him as, you know, the one guy in the band. And then I would get there before him, teach the people the material so that when he walked in, he didn't even have to have a rehearsal, you know?
Okay.
Which is really a great apprenticeship, but not necessarily something you want to do throughout your life.
Right.
But he was
right.
a wonderful guy. Anyway, he told me he knew that he grew up with Leroy Jenkins. And then I was also studying classical violin with an African-American violinist. And the reason I mentioned that he's African-American is because he was a virtuoso violin player. His name is Elwin Adams. And he had to move to – he couldn't get a job in the United States in a mm-hmm. classical orchestra. So he moved to – France, and he became the concertmaster of the Symphony of Bordeaux. And then he wow. moved back and became a violin professor at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And he would
oh.
give me violin lessons. And then I told him, I told Bo and Elwin that I was going to move to New York. And Bo's like, you're crazy. Because Bo never lived here. You know, he didn't. After he left, he wanted to live in a small town and have a farm and have his workshop where he built those guitars and stuff. He didn't. He was not interested in the city. And he said, those people in New York are crazy. You're crazy for one another. And then Elwin Adams said, well, when you go to New York, I have an old student. And he said, I have two other students before you who wanted to be improvisers. One of them was, I can't remember the name of the guy, but the guy who played violin in the Dixie Dregs. And he said, you know, I had that student. And he said, he's a lot better violin player than you'll ever be. And he said, and my other student is Leroy Jenkins. So you got to look up Leroy when you move to New York. So I did. And I ended up, you know, I became friendly with Leroy. And if I may say so, my string quartet maybe did the classic version of his string quartet, which is on a new world record. And if you get time, I hope you could play some of that. Okay. I was very pleased, as I'm sure, as I know Leroy's wife was, because she called me a couple weeks ago. And she called me and she said, Dave, you're recording with Leroy's, like, best of string quartets in the New York Times. The New York Times this article that's, like, 5 minutes to make you love string quartet. And I'm going, like, oh, great. You know, that's all I want to read. I didn't want to read it. And she calls me and said, no, you're in there with Leroy. And so she was very happy.
Nice.
As was I. I'm glad people are listening to that. Because he was wonderful. Anyway, I said, you know, Leroy, I know you grew up with Bo Diddley, you told me. And he said, oh, Bo, what a disappointment. He was such a good musician. He really could have made some great music. And which, you know, it's just nuts, right? Because, I mean, for God's sake, he founded rock and roll. But that's exactly what Leroy told me. And then Bo came in to play the bottom line. And my friend Tom Gartland was the sound man at the bottom line. So he tells me, yeah, you know, I can get you in. I used to go the bottom line for free because my friend was the sound man. And so he goes, oh, I'll bring you backstage to say hi to Bo. And I saw him and I said, you know, Bo, I bear regards from Leroy Jenkins. And he goes, Leroy? Leroy's still alive? And so I told them, I got them back together. And they started emailing.
Wow.
And said, okay. But it goes on from there. So at the time, I was playing in a band with Maureen Tucker, Mo Tucker, who's the drummer from the Velvet Underground. And Mo had been telling me that the reason she fell in love with music, sort of like, in a way, me with Paul Neary. I mean, I loved music before I heard Eddie, but Eddie made me want to be a composer. But Mo Tucker told me the reason that she fell in love with music was by watching Bo Diddley. She adores. She's still around. And so she adores Bo Diddley. That's her hero. And I said to all three of them separately, because I happen to know all three of these people from seemingly completely different scenes. You wouldn't put the Velvet Underground together with Leroy Jenkins with Bo Diddley, but
in fact, not from different scenes.
And I went to each of them and I said, if I could get the money somehow to do this, would you guys do a trio record? Because it would be the best rock trio record ever made. You know, Leroy on violin, because Leroy could really play R&B type rhythms, because he had a band called Sting, which was really a good band. So he knew exactly how. I know that you don't think of Leroy Jenkins in funk rhythms, but he absolutely knew. Growing up with Bo Diddley in Chicago, of course he did. But it really came out with that particular band of his, and they were all like, actually Bo and Leroy said, you got to come up with at least $10,000 each for us to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to every rich person I knew, every single one, and nobody would do it.
Oh,
and of course, now it will never happen. I know now I'd fund it with my good day job. I just funded it out of my pocket. But back then I didn't have any money. I couldn't do it.
But
at least I had them
idea.
All willing to do it. We can imagine what that band would have sounded like.
Oh, yeah, that's what we'll have to do. But what just the idea that those three could have been together. Leroy Jenkins wanted to.
I mean, in a way, the Velvet Underground, if you listen to them a different way, you can say the Velvet Underground almost kind of did that in a way. It almost kind of is like Bo Diddley, and I'm not saying Lou Reed is Bo Diddley, and I'm not saying John Cale is Leroy Jenkins, but in a way they you know, in a way it actually would have worked beautifully. And you know, Bo's lyrics are as bizarre and surrealist as any lyrics that anybody's written since. I mean, Bo can certainly match, I don't know, Bob Dylan or, you know, whoever it is that writes very sort of surprising, surrealist lyrics, Lou Reed or anybody. Bo can absolutely match any of them.
Hey, just ask a question about the Leroy Jenkins piece that you performed. Is that Themes and Variations on the Blues, or was that something else that you did?
Exactly.
That's it.
So
okay,
that's
great.
The piece that's only a quartet. We did some other stuff with them, but that one is just only a string quartet.
Great. I'll try to find that. Hey, in the theme
I have some other stuff by Leroy, but I don't think that I have any other pure string quartet. I don't know if he wrote other string quartets other than that one. He definitely wrote lots of pieces of strings, but just a pure quartet. I'm not sure if he has anything beyond that piece.
Okay. And sticking with the violin theme, you sent me a video of a piece that you arranged, you've resurrected and arranged, that Stuff Smith had started, the great violinist. That was really interesting. How did that, for people that know, Stuff Smith was one of the, I think one of the great, great violinists ever.
Oh, the and greatest, he, yeah.
Yeah, there was something magical about what he was doing with that instrument. I can't put my finger on it, but it was magic.
I completely agree.
I actually told you a story via email. I'll share it with the listeners. I played a little violin, and I heard some Stuff Smith, and it was like the first time I'd heard it, and it just lit me up. And then I laid down and I took a nap. And according to my roommate, I got up in dead asleep and started playing the violin asleep. I was so inspired, and then I put the violin down and went back to bed. So that's Stuff Smith. The effect he had on people. So you found some of his material, a composition that he started, didn't finish, or how did you come across it, and how did you end up investing the effort?
Okay, this happens. There's an enormous Stuff Smith fan who got to know him before he passed, got to know him quite well, named Anthony Barnett. And this is a writer. He's a poet and writer, and essentially has a record label in London. And Anthony has been the big, for some reason, I mean, he is a musician, but I think, you know, he's mostly active as a poet and a publisher. And he fell in love with jazz violin, especially Stuff Smith. But he's also produced, you know, great collections from Eddie South and Stefan Grappelli and even people you probably have never heard of who were great but just never became that big stars like Alec Butchick. Even, this is really weird, but Louis Farrakhan, you know, the Louis Farrakhan, started off as a jazz violin player.
No way. Is he a Chicago guy?
Yeah, yeah. He made jazz violin records. Louis Farrakhan, I'm not kidding.
The world's an amazing place.
Yeah.
Did he go to DuSable, do you think, too? Because I know Leroy Jenkins, of course, went here.
Yeah.
For people that don't.
Yeah, we were kind of mentioning that by email. No, a great, great number of these people from Chicago, saxophone players, and even big stars like Dinah Washington and Bo Diddley and
Nat King Cole.
Not just Johnny Hartman. Nat King Cole studied at one, you know, famous teacher named Walter Diet in Chicago. This guy produced generations of African American teenagers who went on to completely transform jazz and American pop.
I had a friend.
Really important role.
A friend who's passed away now, Jerome Cooper, who actually was in a group called the Revolutionary Ensemble, I think it was called,
with Leroy.
He would regale me with tales about what it was like being a student of Walter Diet, Captain Diet. Those kids, when they graduated from high school, were fully functional, top draw session musicians. I mean, they were there at age 18. You know, they had every professional skill.
Do you think Threadgill studied under Walter Diet?
You know,
because he's kind of the way that he covers both, you know, from Howlin' Wolf up to you know, the outer reaches of science fiction music is really seems like a kind of a Walter Diet legacy. But I never asked Henry about his
I kind of have a visualization of the list of his students, and for some reason I don't mentally.
Well,
he
probably
I don't
just went to a different high school.
Yeah, but it is remarkable that this one guy could generate so much music. But apparently, he was it was deadly serious, and I think the view in that era was we've got to give these boys, because they were children, some chance to survive. And
yep.
So one of the ways they can survive is in the profession of music. And so
exactly.
It wasn't just Chicago. You know, if you look into Detroit.
No.
You know, Fort Worth.
Yeah, well, look at Stevie Wonder, you know, from Detroit and Lansing.
Yeah.
But it's not just that. I mean, it's still now. It's just, I mean, sadly, one thing that's changed is that being a musician is no longer really a promising way to make a living. You know, so I hope society changes again, and it can be. But, as you know, I wrote a bit about this in the introduction of my book, but even starting in Renaissance Italy, the music schools were literally developed. The reason they're called conservatory is because conservatory meant essentially an orphanage. It was a place to conserve
mm-hmm.
children. And
mm-hmm.
so the orphanages mm-hmm. called conservatories became the place to get a musical education. And a lot of these people, like even people like Scarlatti and Cimarosa, you know, really classic as you can get in classical music, were essentially orphans that were raised in those conservatories to become musicians, because that would give them a living. Because you didn't have a parent who was a shoemaker, you know? They needed something else.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and of course,
you know,
Louis Armstrong.
I hope society has not just ended that. Because that would be a horrible ending to a great tradition.
It's something we talk about on Jazz on the Tube a lot, which is, you know, just how, because beyond important music education opportunities are to provide to children. It's just, you know, after food and clothing, I think it's the next, and roof, I think it's the next best thing we could do for children. You know,
the inability to charge people for your music, you know, now it's all quote free. It's not really free, but people aren't paying for it. You know, there's still a tremendous amount of money, but it's not going to musicians, as you well know. It's going to Spotify and Google and many.
And Apple.
You know, and Apple, and then people that own rights to, you know, the publishing of big songs and stuff. But it's no longer going to musicians. I mean, I know it's been going in that direction for a long time, but I think right now it's almost impossible to make a living as a musician. You know, I don't think people are yet quite admitting it, but it's kind of true. And I really hope we can figure our way out of this terrible dead end. This is just a disaster for people. So enough soapbox preaching. We were talking about Our imagination of Chicago for some reason. I got a little bit lost.
Oh yeah, no, it's
when
okay.
I started complaining about socioeconomic problems, I got lost.
Yeah, but it is important that people realize that the reason we had these waves of phenomenal musicians was there was an infrastructure for educating children in music, and they were really super inspired educators in many places.
Absolutely. I know I'm going to say this, but Leroy told me that the difference between his generation and the hip-hop generation was literally the training in the schools. But he was very mm-hmm. positive about that, because he said, you know, people are inventing hip-hop now with the instruments that they have, which are not traditional. They're not saxophones and violins. They are, you know, turntables and drum machines and so on. And he said, because you can't kill human creativity.
Yeah, you make that point.
If you look at it that way, I mean, if you look at it from one perspective, you go, oh, isn't it terrible? Kids are no longer being taught instruments. And yes, that is terrible. But you can also look at another aspect and say, isn't that amazing that they continue to create music that has conquered the world even without that? kind of stunning.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you make that point. It's beautiful. The introduction of this book, your book, which by the way is Music, Math, and Mind, published by Columbia University Press. It's a really interesting. The introduction of the book and your view of music and how it all. It's a little hard to articulate, but there's some very important things about music. And one of them is the thing that you just said there, which is that, okay, we don't have what we had before in terms of, you know, an education system for teaching kids music, and yet the music keeps coming. They find a way. It can't be stopped.
Yeah.
So this might be a good time to transition to talking about the book. And again, as I warned everybody at the beginning of this interview, no matter how long Dave and I talk, we're not going to scratch the surface. But actually, before we talk about the book proper, I just want to list the areas of music that he's worked in. And this is from the discography in the book: opera, oratorios and song cycles, orchestra, string quartet, chamber ensembles, solo piano, solo organ, solo violin, and then band leader, arranger, composer, conductor, producer, film scores, and pop arrangements and conducting. And then, of course, you've also done a lot of really interesting music projects. And maybe that's something we could talk about as a way of getting into the book. You create musical opportunities, musical situations that might otherwise never have occurred, you know, as opposed to just getting a group together and saying, well, here we've got some music and we have some arrangements. Let's do something. You expand it a little bit bigger than that. You involve people that may not otherwise have seen themselves as musicians or have had opportunities to be musical, if I'm stating this correctly. Some of your projects.
Well, yeah. I mean, specifically with young kids. But, okay. You know, now that you're saying that, probably, you know, it would be interesting. Well, you know, again, it's a thing that's almost sad to say, but a tremendous amount of great music, including jazz, I'm sad to say, has come out of prisons. And I want, you know, for instance, Joe Pass, right? And Joe Pass is, you know, in some ways about one of the best guitar players that jazz ever produced. You know, there's a lot of great guitar players, but he's definitely one of them. And, you know, he's in prison. And I think that's time that he spent there, which is horrible. But, you know, I think it allowed him to figure things out that other people never even figured out now. I don't want to say anything really terrible, so I'm trying to be careful about the way I say it. It was horrible that he had to spend part of his life in prison.
Well, I think people would be surprised if they had the list of great jazz musicians that did spend some time in prison. I mean, Sonny Rollins, for example, and a lot of guys. Yeah. And
it's like you throw our great geniuses in prison, for Christ's sake.
It's sort of...
Yeah, so, I mean, you know... I mean, of course, you know, so those people knew they were musicians before they went in, but that's a place. And also, I wonder about, you know, making music with the elderly, you know, the people that are essentially confined in a different way. That's something that I think is certainly, I imagine that it could be, you know, a good thing for everybody involved. But it does need devotion. It needs work, and creating the music with little kids needs, you know, it's like, well, particularly when I was in Guatemala and we made a record in about 10 days with, you know, kids from they're Mayans, they speak a language called Chuuk, and they live 10,000 feet high in the air, right? And a couple of them had played instruments before, but most of them had never played a musical instrument. And that, you know, if you do that, it's only 10 days, but on the other hand, it's 10 days of solid work where I did nothing else. Woke up in the morning until I crashed to sleep, except for taking some time to eat. You know, the whole rest of the time was coaching the kids, recording the kids. You know, these projects take some real devotion.
And you've done that also in the city where you take kids that have had no instrument experience at all, and you get them and running and making stuff.
Well, they still, I'm not saying, you know, I get them started and they make this, you know, the Hip Hop Rascals record in East Harlem is a great record. Really, genuinely, it's a great record by kids that none of whom had played an instrument in their life. Okay. And here they are. They're playing all the instruments, writing all the lyrics, they're doing all the singing, but they rely on me or somebody, you know, a person with some technical knowledge to do the mixing, to do the coaching. You know, I'd go, you know, we always start off the same way. And I've done this with all these kind of projects with kids. You know, what kind of music do you like? In the East Harlem, I thought they were going to like salsa because that is, you know, that's East Harlem. You know, that's the, it's called Spanish Harlem. And most of the kids there are Puerto Rican, Dominican, you know, not all, but, you know, it's a Puerto Rican, Dominican et al. Neighborhood. And so the first day I came there, I bought a güiro and a conga drum and all them. No, they're all into hip hop. They just went, okay, then we're going to do hip hop. And, you know, I would bring in a laptop and GarageBand or Reason. I'd say, this is how you do a hip hop drum track. We're going to start off with the bass drum, and here's the key, you know, on a little keyboard, and you play where you think the bass drum is going to be, and then we're going to add the snare drum. And, you know, and I'd give them a little lesson. I'd say, you know, the snare drum, we usually count this in four. So you go one, two, three, four, one, two, and of course they pick that up right away and say, okay, usually the snare drum is going to be on the two and the four. Right? But it doesn't have to be there. And we can start it there and we can change it. You know, and so we'd come up with a drum groove. And when the kids are dancing, you know, then you go like, okay, this is a groove you like. Yeah. Okay, now you're going to write the lyrics. What's the song going to be about? You know, because I always want them to have, the song should be about something. That's part, in my opinion, that's part of the teaching. And, it's going to be about lollipop, you know. And, Do the Lollipop is a particularly nice song, for instance.
Okay.
And, you know, so let's write down the lyrics. And usually once you start writing down the lyrics, then it becomes spontaneous. And they can just improvise lyrics together. And then, okay, we got that. But now there's this other thing called harmony, the chords. And that's important, too. You know, and the bass line. And, you know, these kids have never, they don't even know what a bass is. But they're playing bass lines.
Mm-hmm.
They grow up hearing the music around them all the time.
Gotcha.
And even when they're 4 years old, they can... Or, you know, they can already, they already know it well enough that they can do it. If you give them the tools, they will do it. It's music's amazing.
You know, we're musical beings, aren't we? I mean, we're somehow wired for music, which is kind of strange, but we seem to be.
And like language, in some ways, we learn it when we're really, really young. Doesn't mean we can't. It becomes very hard to learn a foreign language as we get older.
Mm-hmm.
It's less hard to learn a new musical language, but we all know this because we, you know, let's say we're Americans, so we grew up with rock and roll. I'm assuming you grew up with rock and roll. I could be wrong, but I'm just going to make that guess. And when we hear Italians sing rock and roll, we go, that's not an American. We just know.
Right.
We can be fooled, you know. There are people that will fool, but and they'll do the American idiom, but it will just be a little different, and we'll go like, okay, that's somebody from a different country, and they'll do it to us. So, you know, it does have aspects of early learning and language as well. I could say I'm a big flamenco fan, and I have only heard maybe one or two Americans who become really good at flamenco, and I don't think I've heard any American who didn't have flamenco in their family history who became a great flamenco singer. There's some really good American flamenco singers. Like there's a guy in New Jersey named David Castellano, who I think is great. But, you know, his mother's Cuban and his dad's from Granada. So, you know, so he still kind of grew up hearing it, even if he didn't grow up there. I think it's you got to hear this stuff. In some ways, you got to hear it when you're young.
Yeah, and it goes in.
My friend Pedro Cortez, who's the top flamenco guitar player in the country, is coaching a couple of people who are native Spanish speakers and singing flamenco right now. And they sound really, really good. But I can tell you that the people that grew up in Sevilla and Granada are going like, yeah, that's they're really good, but it's, you know, we can tell they're from somewhere else.
Yeah, I guess it has to go in early, and it has to permeate the neurons, I guess, grow trees.
It's very hard. It's very, very hard. And even, you know, for, you know, even, I shouldn't say even, but you and I grew up hearing the blues, no doubt about it. But to really play the blues, it's not easy. You know, it's not easy at all. Because it's a language, and it's a hard language. You know, if you didn't grow up with it around you, it's even, I mean, and I did grow up with it around me. I grew up hearing Buddy Guy and Muddy Waters and all that. I definitely grew up when I was quite young. I was listening to them all the time. But and they have affected me as a composer and a musician a great deal, and I've done many arrangements of their music, and much of my music comes out of that. But can I do that stuff? No, I can't. So I'm not going to be a, quote, blues musician or a flamenco musician. I can't do it. Then there are other styles you can, because even if you don't sound like you're American, you can play rock music. That's a that's one of the reasons that rock music and hip-hop have conquered the world. One reason is because while there's, you know, a certain thing about authenticity in both these musics, they accept people. They accept people from different backgrounds, and jazz too. If you do it your own way, it's fine. I don't think anybody is so stupid as to say Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli can't play jazz. If anybody says that, they're a big goddamn moron, aren't they? Did they grow up in playing that stuff? No, they didn't. But they figured out their own way to do it, and it's absolutely goddamn magic. And everybody who listens to it, who has a pair of ears, can tell. And you can go all over. You can Hugh Masekela. You know, you can be from all sorts of backgrounds. Dollar Brand. You know, there are all these different people from different. There are great jazz musicians in Thailand. You know, you can come to Japan. All different kinds of backgrounds, and it's still jazz. Now you could say, well, it's not jazz like, you know, it's not jazz like Lester Young. No, it's not. But then Lester Young's not like anybody else. So these kinds of music that allow people's own background and individuality and their own personal way of doing things to thrive are very successful, can be very successful, because they're so magnetic. They bring people in. Not only can you find your own way to play or your own way to sing or your own way to dance, right? And fortunately, for some of these kind of music, it's accepted. Now, there are other kinds of music where people become very crabby. I'm afraid the classical music can be like that. Not always, but in some way, you know, you have to play it in a certain way. It has to be written in a certain way, blah, 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 you know. That's great if you come from that tradition. If you're Mozart, you damn well know how to write classical music. But what if somebody came from an entirely different background and falls in love with Mozart? I think they should make room for that. Maybe I think that in part because I do that so much. I mean, I fall, like you've heard, you know, I'm enthusiastic about salsa, and, you know, I'm enthusiastic about all sorts of things that I fall in love with, you know. So maybe I'm particularly attuned to that kind of thing. But, you know, but there, on the other side, there's something about authenticity, which in some styles can mean doing it the way that it's, quote, the way it's done. And you got to do it that way. If you don't do it that way, it's something else. So that's humanity, and it's just something we have to juggle. I'm not saying either one is right. I'm just saying they're good and bad aspects, or good and bad. There are different aspects to
But it really is interesting. I never really had thought about that rock and hip hop and jazz do leave openings. You know, they're. And maybe, I don't know, probably the term open source isn't correct, but they're designed to have openings in it for people to come in with their own imprint on it.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think part of it is how they were developed. They all happen, not happen. They're all three of them were created by African Americans, but also in tandem with all the stuff around them. So, you know, let's say, you know, I don't know if we should go back this far, but like Scott Joplin is doing this thing that really is an amalgam of music from Africa and dance music from France, from Poland, you know, that's really what it is. And then if you go to like Jelly Roll Morton, I mean, my God, that's a mixture of opera and Cuban music and the blues, you know, and a lot of different stuff that, you know, Jelly Roll Morton is astonishing, right? And you kind of had to be that to make that music. So, I mean, that's the example from jazz. But you've got the examples from all these kinds of music. And I think that's one of the reasons. I mean, I guess it's kind of fitting that it was that these were all centrally developed by African-Americans, because not only because a lot of the style came from Africa, but because these people, due to, you know, slavery and what happened afterwards, had to figure out, were forced to figure out ways to make these cultures work in very complicated ways to mm-hmm. play off mm-hmm. each other. You know, and tell the truth, country western came from that too. Same thing. I know
yeah,
people don't think of it that way, but it did.
And people aren't aware of how much crossover there is between country and western and blues and jazz. And who was I listening to?
You listen to old Jimmy Rogers, or you listen to the old string bands. You know, the old string bands were doing music.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
It's so weird. It's like nobody knows this stuff, but it sounds like you do. But, you know, what kind of happened was you had all these Irish guys like Stephen Foster or, you know, Daniel Emmett, or, you know, first generation, second generation Irish people that fell in love with African-American music and then mm-hmm. made these minstrel groups here near where I live. I live in New York City near Canal Street. That whole scene developed just a few blocks from my house in what's now Chinatown, but back then was called Five Points. And there's even still a little house on the Bowery that even now it's an old red brick house, townhouse. And it's got a sign in it that says, this is where Irving Berlin got his start. He was a singing waiter in this house, in a bar that Speakeasy used to be in this house. So all that music, you know, so the guy that wrote Dixie really was the guy that lived here in New York. He's not a Southerner. He's a guy of Irish extraction. And Stephen Foster, same thing. Stephen Foster's from Pennsylvania, but he moved here, and then he wrote all those amazing songs, which are still, you know, Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair and Oh Susanna and all these other things. And they were, you know, I mean, now it's, you know, you can't, I mean, they wore blackface, right? They did minstrel shows. Where's minstrel come from? It comes from, you know, the German and French singers that were traveling from town to town. So they called them minstrels. You know, it wasn't named after slaves. It was named after this European tradition, which in turn came from a Spanish tradition, which in turn came from Arabic tradition. So, you know, all these things are mixtures. Maybe people are just dealing with what's right in front of them. So they think they got this from there, but they don't know where that guy got it from, or that woman got from. So those kinds of music, and here's the thing about country music. So in a way, the string bands, you know, having a banjo and a fiddle playing in a band,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of mm-hmm. from here. I mean, they, you know, Thomas Jefferson sort of had it in Virginia, but it came here to this neighborhood where I'm living right now and got put together as bands. And that's the beginning of the rock band, where these banjo and fiddle and jawbone bands they had back then, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and then they went out to these traveling medicine shows that went all over the country. And the music, even though, you know, a lot of it came from the South because of slavery, I'm afraid, you know, that's why it was already popular. But, you know, these minstrel shows, doing songs from New York, because a lot of those songs, like Carter Family songs, are really written by professional songwriters up in New York City. And,
oh, really?
And they go down there and they become the folk songs, and they became hillbilly music, because, you know, while the rest of the country that wasn't in the hills and the mountains and, you know, the music traditions kind of moved on. They went to John Philip Sousa, and that became, you know, the jazz bands and so on, you know, Buddy Bolden and Louis Armstrong and all that. The hillbilly stuff was, you know, they kind of retained this really New York City Irish African-American sound, and that became, you know, bluegrass. That became Bill Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Monroe,
mm-hmm.
Bill Monroe himself knew all that very well. But then Bill Monroe is a goddamn genius. And then, you know, a lot of the other people that came in later generations are maybe, well, I can't say not of Bill Monroe's caliber, because nobody's of Bill Monroe's caliber.
Sure.
He stands by himself in some ways as the great genius of that tradition, in my opinion.
Sure.
He always said, I got my music from two guys, Arthur Schultz, African-American guitar player. So the blues was in there for sure.
Yep.
And you hear Monroe sing and play and go, the blues is.
Oh, yeah.
And then his uncle, Pen Vandiver, who was Dutch extraction, who played old time fiddle tunes, which were, you know, from Ireland, from England, and African-American. And, you know, he always said, that's where my music comes from.
Cool. Wow. I didn't know that about him, but clearly, yeah, there was definitely some deep magic coming out of him.
Yeah.
I want to just share a quick story with you, and then I want to talk about the book. When Ornette Coleman was 19, his first out-of-town gig, not playing in the neighborhood or in town, was in Amarillo. And at night, after the gigs was over, he said all the hillbillies used to come to this club where they played, and they would jam after hours. And his regular jamming partner was this guy named Billy Briggs. By the way, there's three Billy Briggs from Texas. So there's a fiddle player, a saxophonist, but also a guy that had his own homemade guitar that had all kinds of strange effects on it. And at age 19, Ornette was jamming with that guy for hours at a time, night after night after night, a pure hillbilly.
Oh, you know, you can hear it in his music. And you know that his bass player, Charlie Hayden, was from rural Missouri and grew up playing hillbilly music. Having grown up in southern Illinois and lived in Gainesville and so on, I absolutely understand that and know that scene. While the clubs you might play in might be segregated, then you get together and play. Like I was playing with the Gainesville Jazz All-Stars. You know, I mean, it was, I was playing the bluegrass bands at the same time, and I was playing in classical bands. But one of the things that would tie all the stuff together, because Texas is a very special place for this, where Ornette's from, Fort Worth area. And one of the things that's very, very amazing is if you listen to the records of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, which is these white guys who loved jazz, loved Count Basie. And loved Django and Grappelli. And then, you know, Stuff Smith lived in Texas.
Yeah.
And you listen to some of the great players with Bob Wills, including Bob Wills himself. But Bob Wills was a great player, but he wasn't a great jazz player. But he had great jazz violin players in his band. And he also had great jazz guitar players and steel guitar players in his band. And there's a few other bands like that. There's one called Milton Brown and his Brownies. And the weirdest one of all was this one in California. That was kind of based on Bob Wills, but it was more like Okies, you know, people from Oklahoma that then moved to California, you know, like Merle Haggard, but, you know, the previous generation to Merle. And these guys all played, you know, really kind of hot jazz. And the violin players are playing the most swinging violin you can imagine. And you go like, where the hell did that come from? I am pretty sure it came from because Stuff Smith lived in Texas. And then they all went out to check out Stuff Smith. I believe that's where it came from. I'm not saying it didn't also come from Joe Venuti and Stefan Grappelli. I'm sure it did. But specifically Stuff Smith living in Texas playing down there.
There's a different...
So the music they call Western Swing, it really is as much jazz as it is, you know, polka and whatever. You know, it's that, and it's got a lot of mariachi in it, too. If you listen to the trumpets, they're right out of mariachi bands. So those guys are dressed up in these big cowboy hats and stuff, and some of them were cowboys, but you know, a lot of the cowboys were Mexican, right? And the music makes perfect sense. It's just, you know, people don't think about that. But if you listen to it with fresh ears, and I highly recommend that you would put on a record by Spade Cooley or Bob Wills and check that stuff out, and you're going to go, wow, yeah, it's got big band, it's got Count Basie, it's got Stuff Smith, it's got mariachi. It's got Roy Rogers, because Roy Rogers came out of that, you know.
Hey, let me throw one at you that I only became aware of recently. there was a guy named Eddie Durham. I don't know if that rings a bell with you.
Yeah, yeah, guitar player for Basic.
Yeah, and he grew up deep in the heart of rural Texas. He didn't speak English till he was 14. He's an African American. He's an Irish African American, interestingly enough, connect this with what we've been talking about.
Yeah,
his dad was the local fiddle player. He didn't learn English till he was 14. He was also raised as a cowboy, riding the range and hunting rattlesnakes. His mom was a pure native.
What did they speak at home?
Spanish.
Oh, okay.
He grew up speaking Spanish.
So he was like Irish, Mexican, African American.
And his mom was Native American, and so he grew up with long hair and braids till he was 12 years old. So now here's an interesting thing
about Eddie Durham.
I didn't either.
He's a great rhythm section player.
What's interesting is he actually was the music director of Jimmy Lunsford and Basie and some other really seminal groups, and he also apparently wrote the arrangement for In the Mood, for which he got $5, Glenn Miller got $15, and Glenn Miller's manager got the rest. But that driving rhythm, his daughter just put, I'll say, didn't write a book, but assembled a book out of press clippings and so on. It just came out this year, and there are people who's the great guy at BAI. Who's run the jazz thing for so many years and done such beautiful work. I'm just drawing a blank on his name.
I'm not sure.
Did I say BI? No, I meant KCR. He's so famous.
Phil
Schapp.
Yeah, Phil.
If you ever get a chance, I know Phil's not well right now, or hopefully he's getting better.
Yeah, I've heard that. I hope he's going to be better. He's a wonderful person, Phil.
Oh my God! What an important guy.
Phil. There's only one Phil in the history of humanity. There's nobody else like him.
And jazz would really have a hole in it without Phil, in my opinion. And what he's done to with that station and those devoting an entire.
I recorded a record with Phil, by the way. I have a record.
Oh, really?
With Kurt Vonnegut. Yep, it's called A Soldier's Story. I created with Phil with Vonnegut. Vonnegut. It's a long story, but Vonnegut is on the record. He plays the part of a general, and Phil, and we needed somebody to play a radio announcer. I said, let's get Phil Schapp. So I have a record with Kurt Vonnegut and Phil Schapp.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Well, if you ever, Phil waxes eloquent on how essential Eddie Durham was to the swing feel, injecting it into the bands. Now, when you think that he's from rural, deep rural Texas, speaking Spanish with a Native American mother and Irish African American father, suddenly West, jazz looks a little different. It's so interesting. Hey, let's switch gears because I want to make sure we let people know about this book. And we're going to, I guess, as I said at the beginning of the call, Dave has at least two hats. One of them is musician, music lover. And the other is scientist. And this book, Music, Math, and Mind, is so interesting. And he made a point, which is absolutely true, that this book could not have been written until relatively recently. And I'm going to describe the book. And Dave, and tell me if I'm on track or off track. What Dave's done with this book is he's taken music, this thing that we all love, and then he's taken, I'm thinking of the famous Venn diagrams, And then he's taken a body of knowledge like mathematics, and he's shown how music, how mathematics can describe music in a unique way and shed light on music, and also how music can shed light on mathematics. And he's done the same thing, not just with mathematics, but also with physics, and also with physiology, and also with neurology, neuroscience. It's a fascinating book. So each chapter takes one body of scientific knowledge and kind of riffs, basically. You riff on how this branch of science could inform somebody's understanding of the phenomenon, this amazing phenomenon of music that, we could talk about forever and still not even scratch the surface of. So this thing obviously took a long time to put together. How long have you been working on it?
Well, it really only took about a year, and I'm working full time, and I would take my laptop on the. So I live in downtown New York, and I work up in Washington Heights at a medical school up there, and so I can be on the subway for 2 hours a day,
Yeah, sure.
So I'd write, you know, I'd write part of it going uptown and then another part going downtown.
Oh my
so
God! That's you're drawing.
My writing done.
But you're drawing on years and years and years of stuff that you've
that's
learned.
That's right. And one great reason it was pretty fast for me to put together was because about 5 years ago, I started teaching course in this in the music department.
Okay.
Or they call it the sound arts department. It's now run, you might know her, it's run by a composer and koto player named Mia Masoka.
Oh, don't know her.
So anyway, she runs that department. It's called the sound arts department. And so I started teaching this course. You know, I just volunteered to teach it. But part of the reason I volunteered to teach it was because I was interested in these questions myself. You know, I've been a musician my whole life, and I'm going like, okay, but why is this out of tune? What does it mean to be out of tune? Mm. You know, why do people play in patterns of threes and fours? You know, why do you go from, you know, if you're a jazz musician, why do you go from the tritone in a five chord to one chord? You know, we know all these things. And if you went to music school, you were trained in these things, and you know the rules. I mean, you can break them or obey them or do both, but you know them. But you don't know why. Doesn't this start to drive you a little nuts at some point? Because musicians and artists are curious, and nobody tells you. But all these things have an actual basis. There is a genuine basis, for instance, for the jazz musicians who are fans of your show, and any jazz musician knows you go, you know, in the standard, you're going to go from an E7 to a D minor, 7 flat 9 to a G7, maybe with a sharp 9 to a C major 7. Everybody who's a jazz musician, nobody who's not a jazz musician knows what the hell I just said, and everybody who's a jazz musician goes, yeah, of course. Of course that's what you do. You don't have to do that, but that's the thing you do. You do it when you want to. And if you do that, you sound like you're playing in a certain kind of tradition.
You know it will work.
Well, why?
You know
why?
It will work. Yeah. You know
it's going to work. You know it's going to work, and you know it's going to, quote, sound right. It's going to sound right. And what I just told you, you can go to the piano right now and do it, and it's going to sound right. In fact, you're going to say, oh, yeah, that's the style that's kind of like, you know, George Gershwin through Duke Ellington and Jerome Kern up to about now, you know, because it could... You definitely could put it into, you might have to reharmonize Taylor Swift a little bit, or who's the flute player now? That woman who plays flute and sings. Anyway, space your name out. You know, like it could be, but it would sound like a little overly sophisticated maybe, but not much. It would just sound like a reharmonization of any, you know, of a lot of the pop tunes that you're on the radio right now. So, but why? What is it? There's actually mathematical reasons, and I'll tell you one of them is kind of cute right now. If you take an octave, and every musician knows what I mean by an octave, and for people that aren't musicians, it means an octave. This is part of it. If you musicians don't know this, then I would like them to read my book, whether they steal it or buy it. You know, it's not. I just want them to understand this. It means the frequency is twice as fast. Now, if an octave higher means a higher frequency, A220 to A440. If that did not make sense, I want you to look at the chapter in my book, even if you don't pay for it, okay? I just want you to understand that. Now, what happens if you divide that exactly in half, the octave exactly in half? So it's not what you would think. It's not the fifth degree. It's the tritone. That is the exact half. Now, what happens? If you play a tritone, and I know I'm losing every non-musician, but I know I'm getting some attention from musicians. If you play a tritone, if you play the two waves that make up a tritone, like a C and an F sharp, so most of the notes on the piano are a little bit out of tune. And again, if you don't understand why that is, read the book. I go through it very patiently, and you don't need to understand anything more than grade school multiplication. You will have to spend a little while on it to understand it, but you don't need advanced math. You only need grade school math, and you will understand it. So if you play, the C and the F sharp, they simultaneously, they do not reinforce each other. But if you play the C and the G, they reinforce each other. Essentially, I'm gonna make this a little simpler. About two thirds of the time, they're going to show up with the same peaks. They do reinforce each other, and that reinforcement sounds very consonant and pleasant to us. So if you go to the exact half, you come up with something that's very dissonant, and it happens to be. So the C to F sharp is dissonant as it is, and we want it to resolve.
Mm-hmm.
I will. And I don't know if you can hear what I'm. I'll play it. But here's the C note. Here's an F sharp. Right. And what do you want to hear?
Okay.
Well, you want to hear this, right? Right. You want to hear this going to that, right? Now, is there a math reason for this? Yes. This note is actually exactly half between this and this.
Mm.
It's not this, but the other one that it resolves to is the one that is, quote, consonant because the weights reinforce each other. Now, I probably lost virtually everybody listening to this, but I'm telling you that if you spend maybe half an hour reading this stuff, you are going to understand that. And in a certain way, now, is that going to change who you are? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it might not change anything you ever do. But at least you're going to have that feeling of, okay, now I get it. And actually, it could change what you do because it might make you think in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I need to do that for myself, too. I have the same questions. Like we were saying before, if you do something you love, somebody else is going to love it, too, because we're not that different. And the questions that I have are the same questions that I know other music lovers have, too. Of course they do.
And that's an example of the math part of this. You also get involved in an area that's your professional specialty, which is neuroscience and the brain and neurotransmitters. And I'm looking at a section here called Social and Private Synapses to Win Friends and Influence People. And
oh God, I guess that's embarrassing. Okay.
and it's the chapter on the neuro mechanisms of emotion, which, you know, I think that's an interesting
title
topic.
After a long day at work and coming back from the subway.
but I mean, I think all of us at one point or another in our lives have asked, what is an emotion? Where do these emotions come from? You know, what is this all about? You know, they're quite strong
especially if we know the effects of drugs on emotions, we understand that there's a great deal of, quote, neurochemistry happening.
Yeah. And then music, obviously.
And some of that's involved in art, right? Some of those same emotions that we get to by listening to music or watching a movie, reading a book, are working through those same damn pathways. And then we go into, you know, some real detail on that. It's
so
totally understandable. So right now it sounds like I'm making stuff up. I'm not. I'm actually not making stuff up. And you can learn this stuff.
It's you know, it's like, it's as if the whole, I mean, I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but it's as if the whole universe conspired to create a system of mathematics and physics and physiology and neurology so that we could enjoy music.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It kind of seems like that, doesn't it?
All these amazingly complex systems all, like, interface, all come together with us sitting down and grooving on something great.
Yep.
So what's so beautiful about this book is if you have a scientific bent, and again, you don't have to be a super scientist, because it is none of it's easy, but it is clear. So if you work through it, any section of this book, you will get it. And when you get through any given section of the book, you will understand, just as Dave described the ratios, you will understand why. And the effect of the book as you go through it is, like I was saying, it's all these different sciences, math, physics, the way the nerves work, the way the brain processes sound, the way the brain works with emotional states and neurotransmitters. All these things work together so that we can have fun with music. I'm just, as I'm skimming here, I'm seeing the name Joseph Schillinger,
mm-hmm.
of course, who was a huge influence on Eddie Palmieri.
On Gershwin.
He's always,
yeah.
I think
a bunch of jazz musicians of former generations. I think, Gershwin famously, because he directly taught Gershwin. But I think a lot of jazz musicians in the past, I don't think anymore, were reading Schillinger.
And what was the thing? Because I've never understood what Schillinger actually did. I just know Eddie's always, you know, when he's always in interviews, he's always mentions how important Schillinger's work was.
Well, who particularly would mention him?
Eddie Palmieri.
Oh, no kidding. Well, you know what?
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense. With the way that Eddie plays rhythms and does harmony, it makes perfect sense that he would have gone, picked up stuff from Schillinger. Well, Schillinger was this, you know, of course, he died long before he was born, but he came from Russia, and he was this, like, really wacky, weirdo intellectual who's also a musician. And he tried to also figure out the logic of music. Now, he didn't have all these scientific tools available to him, so he figured it out in different ways. And he would do things like the thing I write about is he tried to figure out why rhythm works the way that it does. And so he did it all with graph paper. You can check his books out of the library. I actually bought, volume 1 and 2 myself because I thought they were so interesting. And he says, well, okay, you can count just, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Or you could make it all sorts of fours. So a simple thing would be what, I was telling you, we're teaching the kids to do when little children write hip hop, say, oh, let's more on the 2 and 4. So 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3. Everybody in America grew up with that rhythm. But now what if you put, here's the thing. What if we put a 3 against that 4, right? So it's like bomb, 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 bomb. Well, that's starting to sound a little bit like New Orleans, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he would, and he did all this with graph paper, and then comes up with all these crazy ways to make rhythms, many of which we actually use, and some which nobody's ever used, and some which could be used, all right? And so, he came up with different ways of making rhythmic patterns, and he did the same thing for harmonies, and he did the same thing for melodies, like, some of it's kind of obvious in a way, like you could take a melody but now put it upside down or play mm-hmm. it backwards, But he claimed that Bess, you is my woman. I think he claimed that he helped Gershwin come up with that by giving Gershwin, I don't know if it's true or not, but it might be, because definitely Gershwin took lessons from him. But Gershwin comes in with this melody and says, it's just like, it's a little too boring. And he said, okay, we're going to try writing it upside down and writing it backwards, and he came up with a way to rephrase it. And I have to say, that's one of the most amazing melodies, and also its harmonic changes are stunning, So however they came up with it, or Gershwin or Schillinger's influence on whatever it is. So you're right. I'm not at all surprised that, I guess I am surprised, but it makes sense in retrospect that Palmieri would be a Schillinger follower.
Yeah,
it's so much, it used to be kind of more in the air, and now it's less mm-hmm. so, but that just means mm-hmm. that somebody's going to rediscover it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if you Google Schillinger and System and Palmieri, up come listing after listing after listing. Well, hey, I want to bring people's attention back to the book. I think you have a sense, at least, of who Dave is and his range of interests and his enthusiasm and passion for this thing we call music. And he has put together a pretty remarkable book. This would be a great book to buy for your local library or your schools, if you have a kid in school. This would be a good book for every school to have. I could see a lot of
really
school papers.
Really meant for kids who are learning music in a way. We're just interested
really?
In
okay.
it. Yeah, in
okay.
a way, I think that's the audience, because as you get to be middle age or whatever, you have less time and, you're making a living and all that, and it's harder to concentrate. And this book, which doesn't mean, I think people of any age should be able to read it. I mean, again, all you need to understand literally is like third or fourth grade level multiplication and division. After that, you can get everything. It's true that we're using more advanced math, but I'm explaining it all, and I'm explaining it mm-hmm. honestly. Mm-hmm. yeah, you might usually use calculus to do this, but you don't have to. You can actually do it with multiplication, okay? And that's how I explain it, because I know that everybody that I know that's trained in music or
art, went to art school or whatever, as soon as you mention, you know, sine wave, they just tune out because they go, I'm not going to understand that. I'm not going to listen. Mm-hmm. It's not that they don't want to understand. It's like, I'm going to be lost. But they're not going to be lost with multiplication. Everybody can get it. And the math is actually the same. It just, you know, it's just, you just have to go to the work of figuring it out, but you can. So, and anybody can do it. But the thing is, most books, including most books on music, are kind of, you know, it's a commercial thing. They're made to sell books, and they're made so you take them out, you know, on the beach, and you read it that, you know, a couple of days on the beach, or you read it, you know, when you go to sleep, and, you know, you read it two or three days, you know, for a couple hours, and you got it. That's not this book. This book is not going to do that. So I would think that people, you know, I mean, I'm not saying this to make money. I'm really not. It's publishers are like record labels. They give you an advance, and then you probably never get another penny because they do the bookkeeping so that you've never paid off your advance.
Right, right.
When I say that to people or have not been professional musicians who work with record labels, they're going to go, what the hell are you talking about? And everybody who is a musician and working with record labels knows exactly what I'm talking about. So you get an advance, and usually you never get, generally you never see any more money. So that's happens with publishers too. So I'm not saying it to sell some more books and make more money for the publisher. What I'm saying is you get the book, put it on your bedstand, use it when you fall asleep or if you wake up in the middle of the night, and keep coming back to it because it's going to take a while. It's going to take a while, but it should take a while. As I was saying to you, Ken, before, you know, you turned on the tape recorder, some of these concepts have taken our species a very long time, hundreds, even thousands of years to understand, but we eventually did. You know, if you want to know why there's a scale and exactly why the notes of the scale are where they are, you literally have to go back to Pythagoras in Syracuse and Sicily. And even before that, a lot of people think he got it from India, right? So you have to go back a long time. And sometimes you have to go forward a long time because some of the stuff is just very, very recently found out, discovered, and some of the stuff is yet to be discovered. Mm-hmm. So if it's that long and complicated and it's been this thing that humanity's worked on forever, it's not supposed to be easy.
And let me
I don't want to scare anybody off. So at the same time I'm saying it ain't easy, it's also you can do it. And you really can. You're going to read the stuff, and you are going to understand why there's a scale, why things are in and out of tune, why one instrument sounds different than another instrument, how your ear is able to, you know, what is a wave in the air, right? We all know that music and sound are waves in the air. What does that mean? What's a wave in the air?
Right.
You
know,
but you will understand what waves in the air. Let's start off with waves in water, which anybody can understand. Waves in the air are a little different, but they're not that different. And step by step, you can understand what's moving in the air to make sound. And then you can understand how those movements of air, they're high and lower pressure air that happens when you make a sound, change the shape of small areas in your ear and how that's transmitted into your brain. Okay? And then a bit of how the brain then understands what it's listening to. So you're going to understand all that stuff.
And tell me if I'm wrong. It seems to me that you could take a chapter and you don't have to – this is not a book that you start at the beginning and methodically – you could do it that way. You could also say, well, you know what? I'm really interested in the neuroscience of this. And you could jump to the neuroscience chapters. And they're self-contained. You don't need to have had read the original, you know, first
no,
four
you
or
don't,
five chapters.
But then, you know, there is – I mean, they are in order for a reason. So to understand what the waves of air are when they hit your eardrum, you are – if you don't already know the answer, then you're probably going to have to go back to the section that discusses what waves mean.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, you are going to have to – you know, you have to do a certain amount of jumping around. But you're right. You could start anywhere. If you want to start
you really,
on, you know, how do we hear rhythm? You can start right there. But you may, you know, I might say, okay, for this part, go back to chapter three, you know, and then you go back to chapter three and get it. But I want to make the point that we were talking about learning different styles of music. It's like learning a language. And learning science is also like learning language. So you can't learn. I'm married to an Italian. I'm even a joint American and Italian citizen, okay? And I've been trying to learn Italian now for 15 years. And I'm still pretty terrible. I mean, I go to Italy and I speak Italian to people, but sort of, you know, they laugh at me. And if they know how to speak English, they go right to English immediately. And, you know, it takes a long time to learn a language. And learning science is like learning a language, or it's like learning a new musical style, which just, it's going to take a while. You're not.
Well, you know,
if you've got listeners who play rock and they want to play bebop, or vice versa, right? You go like, oh, rock. If I play bebop, I can play rock. No, not necessarily. You know, learning any of these things is learning the language.
I think you could also say if somebody never got a scientific education and wishes they had had the opportunity, and they love music, this book is going to be an amazing gateway into learning basic science concepts and becoming comfortable with science.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to say that about this for sure. Well, the book, again, is called Music, Math, and Mind, and it's by David Sulzer, S-U-L-Z-E-R, and the Physics and Neuroscience of Music. And like I said when we started this, we're just scratching the surface here. You can find more about Dave. Now, you have a stage name, which is Dave Soldier? Soldier.
That's correct.
Yeah. So you have a website, davesoldier.com, and there you can also find out more about – we really didn't even scratch the surface on Dave's music. I mean, we just – it seemed like we talked about a lot of stuff. We didn't scratch the surface. So there's a lot of very beautiful things that he's been involved with over the decades in addition to this book, and I want to encourage everybody – this would be a beautiful book to buy. We have a lot of people that are involved in their local jazz high school programs and stuff. This would be a great book to be in the school library for the kids that have a scientific bent and aren't afraid of science. Dave, what a pleasure to meet you. I thank our mutual friend, Jim Igo, for connecting us. And I know our Jazz on the Tube listeners are equally grateful to Jim for this.
Well, thank you, Ken. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Great. Well, great. I'm looking forward. And the book will be out in people's hands. I have a pre-publication copy, but I understand it's coming out in April of this year, 2021. So everybody watch
for it. Yeah, probably by the time you have this broadcast, it's probably out.
Great. Music, Math, and Mind. All right. Dave, great to meet you.
Okay. You too. Take care.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.